Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Now, as we come to terms with living with COVID, what do we need to keep in mind or keep our eye on, especially in terms of the ongoing evolution of the virus, the development of, say, new pharmaceutical interventions, as well as new tools in our public health toolkit? Dr. Ravindran Thayan is the head of virology at the Institute of Medical Research, or it's better known as IMR. He joins us on the show today, Dr. Ravi. Now, you know, we're almost 2 years into this pandemic. I'm just wondering whether the scientific community at this point in time kind of fully understands this virus. Is SARS-CoV-2 still an unpredictable enemy? Is the science perhaps giving us a little bit more of an advantage now in terms of telling us how this virus is evolving and anticipating future mutations?
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. So basically, I know, looking back, we had the first cases of COVID way back in 2020, and still undergoing and what we term as pandemic. But we understand the virus more. Unfortunately, because we didn't expect the virus to undergo mutation as what we expect coronavirus does. Back to 2002, we had coronavirus SARS-CoV-1, and which dissipated after 1-2 years, but this particular virus, it seems to be prevalent. Having said that, why is it? Because of the transmissibility. It's highly transmissible, and because the virus, once it goes through, what do you call that, replication, it can replicate in from person to person, and once it's sustained in the community in a very long term, that gives advantage when the virus undergoes replication. There are some intrinsic characteristics of the virus which will happen mutations. This mutation can give advantage to the virus or disadvantage. Unfortunately, what we are seeing, basically looking back way back early stage, we had what we call as Wuhan ancestral, but now you see all kinds of different lineages, what we call as variant of concern. There are at least 4 variant of concern, and what also we have variant of interest. How do they become in variant of concern or variant of interest? Basically, WHO does a risk assessment, and based on a few characteristics, for example, the increased transmissibility in the community, increased costing in hospitalization or even death or even severe outcome, decrease in efficacy of vaccine, the current vaccine, or even decrease in efficacy of therapeutics, for example, monoclonal antibodies or antiviral for that matter. So they use that guidance to say, this is in which VOC. VOC has slightly higher risk assessment compared to VOI. VOI, we have currently only 2, Lambda and Mu, but because they don't fit in the full characteristic of VOC, so they're still lower risk currently.
Ravi, can you help us understand the relationship between IMR and WHO, the global scientific community, in terms of keeping abreast of these changes, monitoring and surveillance efforts that are ongoing? How does Malaysia fit into the global picture, and what is the role of IMR in it?
So IMR is Institute for Medical Research. We do a lot of outbreak investigation as well as research. And also in terms of WHO, we are the National Influenza Center. So, and with that, there are some additional benefits that we can get. For example, when you talk about outbreak investigation, we were the first to develop in Malaysia for diagnosis of the first cases of COVID. Way back, how do we go about this? Actually, we have some database called GSI, which is actually WHO's website, and all kind of information, genetic information of viruses are already stored there. And from that information, we are able to get access because being a WHO and NIC, and in fact, others also can get, as long as you have certain standard, you can get access. And from that information, we design our own primers and probe. And that's very important because by identifying the first case of case in Malaysia, then you can institute the contact tracing other measures. It's very important. So that capability we have. And also because, in fact, now, when you're doing the genome sequencing, we also need to give back. That's why under this genomic surveillance intervention, we do report all our cases that have been fully genome sequenced. We also put back into the GSAT so that people can get access to that information.
Well, I mean, this is quite interesting because, you know, you laid out all the variants of interest and the variants of concern. And I'm just wondering, when Delta hit Malaysia's shores. I'm just wondering, so how did IMR determine that this variant of concern was a concern of Malaysia?
So, very good question. So part of our role in Ministry of Health is actually doing the genomic surveillance. We started way back in February. So we get samples, and basically we get samples all over the country. And there are certain criteria, which is we following the, if you look into the criteria of selection of samples, include international entry points. And we did detect our first case of Alpha, which actually originated from UK. We don't put the word country because it's very sensitive, so we say Alpha. Beta is originally from South Africa, Gamma originally from Brazil, and Delta originally from India, but we don't use that anymore. So that Delta was actually detected in people coming in from outside Malaysia, and we detected way back in May. At the same point of time, WHO has declared Delta as variant of concern. Earlier, it was not in that status in that group of concern, but it was also put in May by looking at the parameters like what I mentioned, the increased transmissibility. And having said that, Delta is the most currently the most important variant of concern all over around the world, and is now found in at least 190 countries, more than 190 countries, and it's the most prevalent variant of the virus right now.
Ravin, there is an opinion out there that the world, as it were, or you know, various countries were exposed to the initial virus, the one that came from Wuhan in China, that you know, it swept through the population, we would have built up antibodies that would have helped us in the fight against the future mutations. But because much of the public health response was to try and prevent the spread of the initial variant, or the initial virus, that in some ways bodies are not exposed to the milder form, and now they're going to be exposed to a much more virulent form. Is there any truth in that kind of thinking about the public health response to the virus?
So basically, a very good public health response is to vaccinate as many people as possible. So to do that, you need to have a very good candidate vaccine. So a lot of pharmaceutical countries develop vaccine based on the Wuhan ancestor. So that is way back in February or in January, they used that Wuhan ancestor as their backbone. But I would say that, you know, moving on, there's a lot of diversity in the virus. There are variants of concern. Unfortunately, some of the variant concern do have what we call as immune escape, unfortunately. But having said that, you know, how does the vaccine work? Vaccine that you give is supposed to prime your body. So the two important functions of your immune system, one is to provide you what it calls humoral response, basically antibodies that are neutralizing the virus. And second, very important as well, is the cellular response. Cellular response is actually like the army in your body composed of killer T cells or cells that will produce chemokines or phagocytes. So basically, the system works that way. So vaccine, when you give vaccine, it will work this way. Sometimes you do have issues of waning antibody because we know there is also, the decay of antibodies, or sometimes there are some studies coming in and we know it doesn't last very long. But having said that, what do you do that? How do you go about it? Basically, that's the thing. When you want to look at the protection of the vaccine, you have to look at wholesome. That means you have to look at antibody, how long do they last, as well as cellular response. So even somebody who's been exposed and you don't have antibody, but you have to look at what kind of symptom do they have, like how you categorize them, whether they're in category 1, category 2, or which is very mild compared to whether they are in a category 5, which is need probably ICU admission. So that's how we evaluate. So, but now moving on, moving on from pandemic to endemic, we also look at what else is there. Of course, we know vaccine is a very good way of preventing the disease, and as many as possible, you have to give vaccination. But what else is there? A lot of people are doing research or even clinical trial using antiviral. There's some antiviral supposed to be a very good result, as well as monoclonal antibody therapy, because we have to think. Vaccine is to prevent the infections. Once you give the vaccine, you have the protection. But let's say you get breakthrough infection. This is considered as people who are vaccinated, fully vaccinated, but they do have infection. Why is that so? Because in the community, the still virus is still there in the community. So if you go outside, if you're not following certain SOP, slightly you let down your guard, you may get exposed. But you're supposed to, you know, your body's supposed to respond very you're from small. You remember you're given childhood vaccination. Hepatitis B is a good example. And usually a booster comes in when certain people need it. So basically...
Okay. Well, Dr. Ravi, if I may interrupt and just ask you to explain a little bit, because, you know, you brought up the emergence of new antiviral drug treatments for COVID. Molnupiravir, if I'm not mistaken, the government has committed to buying 150,000 doses of molnupiravir as a treatment for COVID-19. And I'm just wondering, how do we think about that? Because you brought up booster shots as well for vaccinations, right? How do we balance between our public health resources, between, say, booster shots and future doses and yearly doses versus investment in new antiviral treatments that may be coming on market?
So for that, a very good example is going back to the last pandemic that we've been exposed. A good example is pandemic influenza 2009, the H1N1. How do we move from pandemic to endemics? Basically, we have a very good vaccination system as well as antiviral, acetaminophen instead. So that's how we move on. So for here, you have to look into what, because basically, you may have issue of weaning antibody. Yeah? Like I think recently, there are a lot of publication as well. And in fact, recently WHO strategic advisory group of experts in immunization have come up with a recommendation where they propose giving, they don't say booster because the word, you see basically why WHO does not say booster is because of, you know, being ethically correct. Because the thing is that, you know, when you say booster, I think you need the evidence of whether it is not protective. So they used a term called a primary series. They will give you a third dose, meaning that it's still the first, second and third dose to only people who may need it. And who are these people? Are people above 60 because they may have underlying medical condition. In spite of vaccination, because the immune response is not as what you think you may be. So they may be admitted in hospital. And when they are admitted in hospital, how the clinician manage them? Just where the molnupiravir coming, antiviral comes in or anything else, not necessarily antiviral, that could be also monoclonal therapy. So how do they work is basically antiviral will disturb the replication of virus by inactivating certain pathway of the replication. And how does monoclonal antibody work is because they neutralize. Basically, when you give vaccination, your body produces neutralized antibody, right? So the same therapy is where you give monoclonal antibody, and the monoclonal antibody will neutralize the virus and becomes inactivate. So these are things that you should have in place. Of course, vaccination and herd immunity is something, but this is what you consider. As far as booster is considered, I think it's like what I said, we had, we have to save the data. So if we have the data, if we don't have the data coming out from other parts of the world, coming out from different parts of the world, for the example, Israel study, showing that you need based on public health intervention when people are, maybe not very well after vaccination because the immune system. So that's why you want to give a third dose. I think are things that we have to consider.
I see. Thank you so much, Dr. Ravi, for joining us on the show today. That was Dr. Ravindran Thayan, Head of Virology at IMR. We're going to take a quick break here on Consider This, but we will be back with more. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutan. And we've been talking about how there's been so much discussion lately about how Malaysia is set to enter the endemic phase at the end of October, as per the Health Ministry. The Health Ministry's recent announcement. Now, what is it that we mean when we say living with COVID? Do we all mean the same thing? Joining us on the show to discuss this further, we have independent health policy specialist Dr. Kaur Swee King. Swee King, let's start there at the beginning of our conversation. I'm just wondering, this phrase, endemic COVID, it's been thrown about quite a bit, by the government, by society, different stakeholders. What have you observed about the use of this word, this term endemic? Has it been different by different stakeholders? Have the definition and the messaging been the same?
Melissa, It's probably very helpful for us to begin with an understanding of the definition, the textbook definition in public health, or what's the meaning of the word endemic. I think that's a good place to start. What endemic means is that there is a background, baseline, continuous presence of a disease. In this case, it's COVID in a community. So, in other words, COVID is permanently here, it doesn't go away. Other examples of endemic diseases would be dengue, which is permanent in Malaysia. It doesn't go away. Dengue, we have about 130,000 cases a year in Malaysia and about one death per day from dengue. Another example of an endemic disease is tuberculosis. We always have tuberculosis in Malaysia. Every year, we have approximately 25,000 cases with approximately 5 to 6 deaths per day. These are just two examples of infectious diseases in Malaysia that is considered endemic. In other words, it's permanently part of the landscape. That's the public health definition of endemic. However, many factors in health are actually very political. And endemic, the word endemic, also has a political angle to it. What I mean to say is there is actually no public health cutoff or epidemiological cutoff after or a time point after which a disease becomes endemic, or there is also no universally agreed upon metric as to the number of cases after which a disease is considered endemic. These things require subjective judgment. And in that subjective judgment, professionals can disagree with all the best intentions in the world. Epidemiologists, public health physicians, infectious diseases physicians may disagree on when a disease actually becomes endemic. It's also very helpful to consider that an endemic disease is not a on-off switch. It's not like a disease is endemic and then it goes back to being nothing, and there's no clear line either in time or the number of cases that we can consider a disease to be endemic. Finally, I'll add on the third element over here about endemicity, which is a noun for endemic, and endemic is the adjective. For endemicity, Malaysia will have to make some social contract decisions. And these social contract decisions are an agreement between the government and the people of Malaysia. To what extent are we able to tolerate the number of cases and the number of deaths due to COVID before we consider that we're back in some state of a medical emergency or public health emergency, that we have to reimpose some measure of lockdown? Remember those numbers that I gave: one death per day from dengue and 5 to 6 deaths per day from tuberculosis every day as a baseline. Are we willing at the moment to tolerate tens or hundreds of deaths from COVID on a daily basis before we accept that COVID has become endemic, and that level of tolerability, or what number is, what deaths are acceptable, tolerable, or reasonable, are very difficult decisions that the government of Malaysia will need to start engaging with the people of Malaysia to achieve some sort of a social contract.
Speaking, you bring up a very important issue, I guess, which is the people. The people is such a abstract notion, isn't it? I mean, there are very different responses in Malaysian society. You would have seen it yourself between those who, who want to go back to normal, as it were, go back to pre-COVID days, and those who are living in their little own fortresses, they turn their homes into fortresses, they're terrified to go out. How do we, in a situation like that, how do we, come to a kind of consensus about the tolerance for, say, death or infection rates in the country?
Sure. This is a great question, an exceedingly difficult one to answer. So let me offer two thoughts, one more philosophical and principled, the other one a lot more practical. In the philosophical part and more principles part, that conversation requires a lot of sensitization, meaning to move from a pandemic situation to an endemic situation means that we change the mindset and the vocabulary of Malaysia's government practices. We shift from a campaign mode, which is very short-term and short-lived, to a routine mode. I'll repeat that because it's quite important. To shift from a campaign mode to a routine mode so that we sensitize the population that COVID is not going to go away, that we all need to develop the ability to do self-risk assessments, not just rely on the government to tell us when it's risky, but we make all these assessments for ourselves. When is it safe for us to send our child to school, for us to go to the shopping center, and for us to go to Langkawi, for example? That move from a campaign mode to a long-term routine mode will gradually and sensitize the Malaysian government, sorry, the Malaysian people, in understanding that COVID is not going to go away. That's more philosophical. But allow me to be a little bit more practical, Sharad. This requires us to understand our health system utilization in Malaysia, which means that our previous emphasis on the number of cases and the number of deaths were very important, but that emphasis needs to shift to other metrics right now. For example, how much utilization is there in our healthcare system? Maybe we need to look at ICU or intensive care unit capacity, whether or not doctors are being stretched, and you can measure that through morale, welfare, well-being, and so on and so forth. Maybe we need to also look at the number of cases in a particular jurisdiction tied to how many MySejahtera check-ins. The point I'm making is I'm just given three examples of new metrics that we can consider in very practical terms to shift the emphasis away from pandemic to endemic without looking only at the two metrics of deaths and total number of cases. Deaths and total number of cases are very important, but they belong to the earlier stages of this pandemic. We've been in this pandemic for nearly 2 years already. We need new sets of metrics to measure an endemic COVID. And once we shift the public emphasis to new sets of metrics as well, it will gradually and over time, it will take months, Sharad, maybe even years for us to shift the Malaysian population to think about COVID in an endemic way. But the more we shift the narratives and the metrics that we focus on and also our underlying campaign mode to routine mode, it will gradually help people understand that COVID becomes endemic.
Well, I really like that, speaking about shifting from campaign mode to routine mode, and also the role of, you know, self-responsibility in the way we live with COVID-19 in the future. But I'm just wondering, I mean, if taking a look at the current picture as is, right, and we talk about moving into an endemic phase of COVID-19, but yet, you know, there's still so much uncertainty about testing, for instance, understanding self-testing, self-tests at home kits. How do we think about that in terms of a risk assessment, particularly when a lot of the burden of responsibility will now fall on the individual, as opposed to, as you said, campaign mode driven by government?
Melissa, another great question and also very difficult to answer. So again, I'll try to answer in two ways. One is more philosophical, the other one is very practical. In philosophical terms, it is probably correct that the Malaysian government is transferring some responsibility to the Malaysian people, because a centralized response, as in Putrajaya knows best, we will decide all the responses all the time for all levels of society, is not sustainable, inaccurate, but perhaps, shall we say, ethically a little fraught. The point being that it's probably correct for the Malaysian government to transfer some of this responsibility to the people. However, when you transfer this responsibility, it's not as easy as, oh, now you're responsible. You have the responsibility, I will assist you with the infrastructure to help you meet that responsibility. It is not, it's your responsibility, and it's entirely up to you, and I have no more responsibility and I'm transferring everything to you. The Malaysian government still has a moral, legal, public health responsibility to make an infrastructure that enables people to make decisions for themselves. So it's not just transfer responsibility, but make it easy for people to meet those responsibilities. That's more philosophical and principled. In the purely practical sense, and let's talk about maybe home testing, it's great that we've got home testing available right now. And it's great that the Ministry of Health is using words like TRISS, or test, report, isolate, seek help, for example, that infrastructure. However, it needs to be accompanied by a lot more health literacy, health education. Number two, it also needs to be accompanied by non-punitive measures for people to be encouraged to report positive tests. Because if I report positive tests, right, and I lose all sorts of privileges because I can't go out traveling, I can't go to work, and if I'm relying on day wages, I'm a day laborer, if I don't work, I don't get money, and if given a choice between working and getting money to feed my family versus staying at home with no social support whatsoever, I'm going to pick going to work to earn money so that I will not die from hunger. And that's the second example of what the government can do, and not just say, it's your responsibility. So at least in very practical terms, the government needs to provide a lot more health literacy. And secondly, to provide ways that are non-punitive, that when people report a positive test, that they do not suffer the consequences of it. And as a corollary, what we also need to offer are things like maybe 80% wages if you're self-isolating at home for a certain period of time, and this encourages people to report a positive test. In that situation where COVID becomes endemic, tracing becomes a little less important. This is true. However, in a hyper-local outbreak, we may need to still close off a particular jurisdiction. And my opinion is to go to close off a particular district, but not a particular state. And if we can hyper-localize our response to only perhaps provide an enhanced MCO in a particular district, only in selected situations, that could be a more responsible way for us to have a bit of a backstop. So these are very practical ways, Melissa, on top of the philosophical angle that I've just described earlier, how do we can actually operationalize this transfer of responsibility?
So, okay, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Independent health policy specialist Dr. Koswee King there, and he wraps up this episode of Consider This. Before we leave you tonight, a reminder that you can get the latest information on COVID-19 vaccines at astroawani.com as well as the Astro Awani app. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching and good night.